optical telescope. It's 332 feet across, and that's there in Green Bank, West Virginia. And that replaces a 300-foot telescope that I used back in the 1970s, same location. They tore. Well, actually, what happened is a windstorm came down and blew the telescope down. And at the time, it was the world's largest fully steerable telescope, and they actually built it for just $600,000. But it wasn't all that stable. Windstorm came down, completely collapsed it. So they replaced it with one that cost a few million dollars. So that's it. But this was the instrument that was used to demonstrate the feasibility of being able to measure the expansion and the acceleration of the universe in real time, and actually prove that this instrument could give us a result which would establish exactly what cosmic creation model is responsible for the universe coming into existence in just 125 years worth of observations. And, you know, they've already done 13, so we only have to wait, you know, 90 more years and we're all done. So, and this is a close-up of that particular instrument. And the paper really was making the point, okay, we can do it in just, you know, another 90 years with this telescope, or we can do it in 5 years with this set of instruments. And this is what's referred to as a square kilometer array. And they're using these small antennae. They're each about 20 feet in diameter, and but they're looking at thousands of them. And this would be, this is what's called the central core in the desert of Australia. They have another one just like it. And by the way, this isn't built yet, but the financing's in place. And by 2019, it will be fully operational. So by 2016, they're going to begin the major construction of this. And there'll be another central core just like this in South Africa. And then coming out from each of these central cores will be arms that are 2,000 miles long, so or 2,000 kilometers long. So it's going to spread all over Australia and all over southern Africa. But the collecting area will be 16 times the collecting area of this instrument. And with that instrument, it'll be able to establish, and without making any assumptions at all, exactly which Big Bang creation model explains the history of the universe in just 5 years. So by 2024, we're going to have a proof of cosmic creation that no atheist, no young Earth creationist can possibly dispute. So we already got good apologetics now, but this is going to give us really definitive apologetics. Well, because what you're doing with this instrument, you'll be able to observe the expansion and the acceleration of the universe in real time. Because what you're doing is you're measuring the velocities of galaxies relative to us today, and then measuring it again 2 years from now, 3 years from now, 5 years from now, and there will be a difference. And the difference you get will tell you which model of the universe is correct. You know, different atheistic models will predict a certain number. Young Earth creationist models predict a certain number. Different Big Bang inflationary models will predict certain numbers. So this will not only be able to prove that the universe arose from a Big Bang creation event with an actual beginning of all matter, energy, space, and time, it'll actually be able to tell us exactly what kind of inflation event took place when the strong nuclear force was separating out from the electroweak force. That's kind of been the holy grail of cosmology for the last 15 years to be able to do that. This instrument will probably be able to do it faster, this one here, than any other attempt. There's several ways of doing this, but this one they'll be able to do it in just 5 years as opposed to us being able to do it in 100 years. Yes?
Why are they both in the southern hemisphere?
The reason why they're both in the southern hemisphere, there's a couple of reasons. They can take advantage of the big deserts there where very few people are living. And so it's easy to get the land to put all these things up, and they won't have to worry too much about interference. And also, what they're wanting to do, this is radio astronomy, And in radio astronomy, you not only get the amplitude information from the light coming in, you get the phase information. And because you get both phase and amplitude, which you don't get at optical wavelengths because of the atmosphere, that means that you can take all the telescopes in South Africa and integrate them through interferometry with all the telescopes in Australia, and actually through good software build the equivalent of a telescope that's 6,000 miles in diameter. Now the problem is, you put them in the northern hemisphere, you're going to be very difficult to get both. Well, no, the problem is being able to focus on particular objects. And so all the telescopes need to be able to see the same object at the same time. And if you've got too long of a baseline, that's no longer possible. So, and by the way, for some sources, only one continent will be used, so you'll only be able to use half the instrument. But there's still, that's a lot of collecting area. But yeah, for the full area, you want to have a somewhat limited baseline. Yes?
I was aware that there's different theories of the expansion rates. But I'm
there
not
are.
Really aware of the implications of all that. Is there a place for a layman like myself to go to sort of understand the different theories? And then, I would think the Big Bang is the Big Bang, whether you're an atheist or a theist, but apparently not.
Well, I mean, atheists, for example, are aware that your standard Big Bang creation model demands the existence of a being beyond matter, energy, space, and time. So they're speculating about alternatives. And their alternatives have to do with maybe the universe isn't accelerating or decelerating at the rates that certain astronomers claim. And they're taking advantage of the fact that, in particular, we're not able to measure with precision the rate of change in the expansion of the universe when the universe is young. Because the problem there is you have to be able to make observations on galaxies that are 10, 12, 13 billion light years away. And those galaxies are really very, very faint. And to do this kind of work, you not only need to be able to see the galaxy, you have to be able to see hyperfine split spectral lines from those galaxies. Now, fortunately, the strongest spectral line at radio wavelengths is a hyperfine split line. It's a 21-centimeter line of neutral hydrogen. So it's the strongest spectral line we see in radio astronomy, which means that we can see it out to great distances because it's such a bright spectral line. However, if you want to be able to get an axiom, it's not just to be able to see the spectral line, we need to be able to measure with high precision the frequency or the wavelength of that spectral line. And that requires a high signal-to-noise ratio, which means you're going to need an instrument like this. So, for example, this instrument does not have an adequate signal-to-noise ratio to make the necessary measurement. You can integrate over a long period of time. So one way to solve it is to simply do observations for 125 years. But another way to do it is to get a telescope that's more sensitive. So with a higher sensitivity telescope, you don't need as many hours of observation. So this is why this could be done in 5 years with this instrument, whereas it would take 125 years with that instrument.
If everybody agrees on the Big Bang, are the atheists hoping to challenge the fine-tuning by faulting the expansion?
Well, they're trying to challenge two things. They're trying to challenge the idea that there's a causal agent beyond space and time.
How could they possibly do that?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's something we argue at Reasons to Believe, that we're already past that one. Because even the multiverse theories that atheists propose are all subject to the space-time theorems. So you're really, and this is something that the more studious atheists acknowledge. So for example, if you pick up a book by Lawrence Krauss, he admits in the book that we cannot escape a causal agent beyond space and time. And so he says in the book that deism is something that's clearly on the table. And that, but his real goal, as with a number of atheists, like another good example would be Stephen Hawking. He's also, just like Lawrence Krauss, aware that we can't escape a deistic conclusion for the universe. But his goal is to escape a theistic conclusion. where God is not only a being beyond space and time that creates space, time, matter, and energy, but that God is also a personal being. A personal being who would actually be watching your life, evaluating and judging your life. That's the kind of being that they want to get off the table. And yes, that's where the fine-tuning argument comes in, and that's where this experiment comes in, because this experiment will not only be able to more firmly establish the fine-tuning and dark energy, the factor that accelerates the expansion of the universe, but tell you exactly where the fine-tuning exists. That's something we can't do now. We do know there's fine-tuning there. We know that the fine-tuning is spectacular and demands the existence of a personal being. So when I speak on university campuses, that's what I do with the atheists. Say, hey, it's not just deism, it's theism, because we can measure the level of fine-tuning in this term. But a lot of them will come back and say, yeah, we can measure it, but we still don't know what's responsible for the fine-tuning. That's where this experiment comes in. It will tell us what's responsible for the fine-tuning. Well, astronomers already have a hint. They suspect, because the measurements are showing this, that it's probably as a result of Einstein's cosmological constant. However, we only see the constancy of dark energy to maybe about 10% precision over the past 8 billion years. We don't have the telescope power to explore its characteristics over the first 6 billion years. And so that's what instruments like this are capable of doing. They're going to be able to measure with precision what's behind dark energy when the universe is very young. And that will tell us whether or not dark energy is governed by a single physical constant, two constants, three constants, and what the fine-tuning in each of those constants would be. Now, as an astronomer and the president of Reasons to Believe, I'm on record as predicting when we can make these measurements, the fine-tuning evidence is going to go up, not down. But we need the instruments to be able to do this. Yes? If it's something you cannot measure, it's not physics. That's true. Well, for a long time, and this was true when I was a young boy, they were saying that physics can't touch God because we can't measure God. But it was an atheist Chinese astrophysicist, Fang Liji, who wrote a book in the 1990s, who said that physics is now advanced to the point where we're able to actually measure and test theological concepts. And he's referring to the fact that physics, and really it's astrophysics, has the ability to make measurements on the universe when it's extremely young, when it's literally only 10 to the minus 34 seconds old. And that actually gives us measurable conclusions about what's responsible for bringing the universe into existence. Now, it's not that you can use astrophysics to establish minute details of the triune nature of God, but it is such that you can establish there must be a causal agent beyond space and time who is a personal being that brought the universe into existence. Yes. Well, it's actually stronger than that. And, you know, because the one thing about astronomy that makes it such a powerful science, you're directly measuring the past. You're not extrapolating to the past. You're not inferring the past. You're not deducing the past. You're actually directly measuring the past. Now, that's a strength of astronomy. A weakness of astronomy is we have no ability to measure the present. We can only measure the past. And we measure the past through the fact that it takes light time to get to our telescope. So if we were to observe 13.7 billion light years away, an object that's that far away, we are literally looking at a time when the universe is just a short time after the cosmic creation event.
Is there a specific
Correct.
Okay. And the precision measurement, etc. It only tells me the experimental evidence. Okay. And in the future, we can have far more refined
right.
Evidence or different, totally different kind of evidence.
Right.
That tells what existing theory is all wrong. Or possibly right. Whatever. So there's always a provision of understanding, empirical finding, just that, empirical.
Well, let me put it in this context. You know, we were able to make measurements of the positions of planets with high precision starting at the beginning of the 20th century. And what we noticed was that the predictions in Newtonian mechanics weren't exactly correct. When we were making measurements to six places of decimals, we were finding discrepancies. Very tiny, but there were discrepancies. And this is what led Albert Einstein to develop his theory of relativity. And because he was noticing Newtonian mechanics could not accurately predict the movement of the perihelion point of Mercury's orbit. It was off by a few arc seconds. And his theory of relativity actually got the right answer. And today we can make measurements of special relativity to 21 places of decimal. It's still getting the right answer, even at 21 places of decimal. Now, does that mean that we were wrong about Newtonian mechanics? No, it simply means that there was an additional piece of physics that we couldn't see until we were able to make measurements to 7, 8, 9 places of the decimal. And so when we send a spaceship to Jupiter, do we use general relativistic calculations to get the spaceship there? We don't bother. The correction factors are so tiny, we don't even need to consider them. We just use straight Newtonian mechanics. Well, it wouldn't surprise me that when we can make measurements to 40 places of the decimal, we're going to find another theory that will complement Newtonian mechanics and general relativity. But will that mean that we have to throw general relativity? No. It's still going to be, in fact, you know, experiments have been done that demonstrate that of all the principles in physics, general relativity is the most exhaustively tested and the best proven. But it doesn't mean it's going to be a permanent theory that will always give us the right answer in all contexts, because we can only prove it to 21 places of the decimal. When we get to 40 places of the decimal, we may find another underlying theory that will complement. But the reason why I'm belaboring this is that lay audiences often have the idea that science is in constant revolution. We come up with new measurements, new ideas, new theories that overthrow everything of the past. That's a misconception. For example, when we teach undergraduates physics, for the first 3 years of intense physics education, all we're doing is giving them the physics of the 17th, 18th, and 19th century. When you get into fourth year, you get the 20th century stuff. When you go to graduate school, you get the 21st century stuff. And, you know, the stuff that Faraday and James Clerk Maxwell were discovering back in the 19th, 18th, and 19th century, it's still true. It's still in all the textbooks. We still teach it to all of our students. It's not a revolution, it's a refinement. And so the same thing works theologically. We have these amazing instruments that can tell us things about God, but there's a limit to how much they can reveal about God because of the limitation of the instruments and our ability to make measurements. And actually what's happening at the theological front of these astrophysical theories and experiments is that we're more limited by systematic errors than we are by random errors. Now the difference is this. A random error is how strong is the signal above the noise. A systematic error are instrumental effects that may shift the measurements a certain degree in one direction. And that's, in cosmology, that's really been the problem, is trying to figure out where the instrumental limitations are to making the measurements. Now, for example, this square kilometer array, it's going to give us a signal-to-noise ratio about 20 times better than any instrument we have today. But astronomers who already know this is going to be funded and built are already working on the systematic errors, and this is the value of the Sandage test I talked to you about last week, because there are no systematic errors, because what you're doing are making measurements at time one and at a time later, and the systematic errors are the same for both, so they cancel one another off. You're simply left with the limitations of what are called the random errors, the signal-to-noise ratio, which is why I was able to tell you that the Sandage test is assumption-free. There are no assumptions limiting the conclusions that come out from it. We're simply limited by the signal-to-noise ratio, which is why they want to spend $1 billion of your money. It's not all your money, by the way. 10 nations are involved in this. So the U.S. contribution really isn't that large, but we're going to be able to solve not just this problem of what kind of God is behind the universe. This instrument actually has a whole set of breakthrough discoveries it will make. Astronomers believe that of all the instruments now being built, this is the one that's going to lead to the greatest breakthroughs in astrophysics. Bunch of hands are up here. And by the way, I still want to get to the actual measured payoff, because what I mentioned last week is what this instrument can do. I want to tell you what it's already done, because what it's already done also has huge significance for the Christian faith. But you're first, then we'll come around here. Yeah, go ahead. And by the way, there's private funding behind this, too. It's not all coming from taxpayers.
No, because I was thinking, could anybody have any standards that wants to support what it can discover, or are they more curious?
Oh, they're really curious. And by the way, they spent quite a bit of money trying to figure out how to do this cheap. And what they figured out is by building, you notice what's going on here. These are relatively small antennae, which are off-center. By putting the feed off-center, they were able to save a pile of money. So, and, they said, well, it's going to, the image is going to be distorted, but because they're spreading it out over thousands of instruments, the distortion actually becomes quite minimal. And it literally saved a few $100 million. Not bad. Yeah, good deal when you're spending $1 billion. Yeah, go ahead.
That he's not a personal God. So what is a deity would then create the universe and then what, take a vacation? What does he do? Does he go to sleep? Does he go to Miami? What is he?
Well, he probably doesn't go to Miami, but the deistic worldview is that there's a God.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, the deistic worldview is that there's a God out there who's responsible for all the math and the physics, sets up the laws of physics, creates the universe. But having done that, he goes to sleep or takes a long vacation. I mean, take your option. But basically, it's a God that only acts at the cosmic creation event. So he was active 13.73 billion years ago, and since then, he's been doing nothing.
See, aren't you all opening up kind of a, what's the expression of Pandora's box? If you say there's a deity, then you can go from there to all the way through to Jesus and the triune. Jews and this and that. I mean, it starts.
Well, we were actually discussing this before class. I mean, the fundamental weakness of deism is that, if God is only making the math and the physics and then takes a long nap and is not a personal being, is not conscious, has no mind, no personality, is not a spiritual being, how do you explain the fact that we human beings are all of those? We have a mind, we have emotions, we are spiritual, we are conscious, we think, we're alive. How can all that come from something that's not alive, doesn't think, has no mind, no personality, no spirit? You're actually demanding that the greater come from that which is lesser.
So what is Hawking, how would Hawking respond to that, say, or somebody of his nature?
Well, I think Hawking put it best back in 1988 when he said, I do believe that there's a God behind the universe, And my goal in life is to know as much as God knows, to gain the mind of God. Now, he's not the first one to actually have that as a goal.
Could he go to hell for that?
Well, as I said, he's not the first one to have that as a goal. The first one to have that as a goal was Lucifer. He wanted to be as God and know as much as God knows. And this is where I'm concerned. I mean, a friend of mine actually lived with Stephen Hawking for 4 years, had Bible study with him every morning over breakfast and a prayer. And Hawking was fine with that. But what my friend told me was that where Hawking would draw the line is whenever he started talking about a personal God. And it says, whenever that happened, you've got the famous Hawking smirk, which means end of conversation. Don't want to go there. Now, he's also declared why he doesn't want to go there. If God is a personal being, then that God is probably watching and evaluating us, which means that we are no longer autonomous. And that means that we're not going to become like him. So,
we're not going to become like who? Like God?
Like God, yeah. I mean, God's going to do great things with human beings who receive his gift of redemption. We're going to become much greater, but we'll never have the mind of God.
So
we'll never be God.
So Hawking wants to be like Lucifer, I suppose.
That's the real problem. And God says anyone with that goal will be resisted by him. So, anyway, that's off the topic. There was another comment here. Yeah, go ahead.
Accurate scientific measurements that you can, you're still going to bump up against where is God? He's always invisible. Unless our instruments show him, there he is, you know, lurking behind the Big Bang, we're never going to see him. You're always going to be bumping up against the invisibility factor.
Al, you've just stated a fundamental doctrine of the Christian faith. That God can't be seen, he can't be touched. Well, which makes sense. I mean, if he's the one that created matter, energy, space, and time, that means he is fully capable, fully operational, without matter, energy, space, and time. And we human beings can only make instrumental detections within matter, energy, space, and time. That's the limit of instruments like this. They're restricted to making measurements within matter, energy, space, and time. Well, the very fact, the very fact that God created this universe means that he can't be seen, he can't be detected, unless he chooses to come into our realm. And that was the second person of the triune God. He left his great state and position. As it says in Philippians 2, he humbled himself, put aside the powers he had as part of the Godhead, and chose to become one of us, so we could see and touch him. But he didn't stay in that humbled, lowered form. You know, once he rose bodily from the dead, he once again took up the power, position, and the authority he had before he came here to earth. And, when he left his disciples watched him leave, and then he became invisible and undetectable. Which makes perfect sense, because if God could be detected, if he could be seen, he wouldn't be God.
That's right. He couldn't have a God, because to have a God, and this is all gods all over, they all have to be invisible. Otherwise, they can't be all powerful, all good, and all good. You can't have that and have it a visible God. To me, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's a very astute philosophical point. I mean, if God is visible and detectable, then he's not God. So God has to be invisible and undetectable. Now the question is this. Do we have the scientific instrumentations to prove that such an entity or being must exist? And that's kind of the point that we're making through Reasons to Believe. We actually have the instruments that can prove that. Now there's a second point. Do we have the instruments not only to prove that such a God must exist, can we actually identify what kind of God that is? Because you got the God of the Hindus, you got the God of the Buddhists, the God of Islam, you got the God of Judaism, you got the God of Christianity. Are our instruments capable of identifying which of all those gods is actually the one that brought the universe into existence?
That's going to be tough.
Not as tough as you think.
Is this guy not wearing a robe here, or is this guy wearing
No, forget about the robe idea, okay? I don't care what kind of robe he's wearing, or whether it's visible or invisible. The question is this a God that's a personal God? Is this a God that's capable of love? Is this a God that's actually knowing what's going on in your life?
That's us.
Yeah.
That's us. We made him.
No. We are created in the image of God. But yeah, you are right. There are religions that create God in their image. And that's one thing that was part of my experience in going through the religions of the world, is just noticing how many of the world's religions basically come up with a God in the image of a man. And what struck me about the Christian faith was it wasn't like that. Christianity was unique, and that the God behind Christianity was not God in a human form. It was something completely different and transcendent to what we human beings are capable of. Let me give you a demonstration. Every religion outside of Christianity describes God in a manner that we human beings can visualize, make a picture of. Christianity describes God as a triune being. That's beyond the capability of human visualization, the idea that you could be three persons and yet just have one essence, one purpose, one mind, etc. We can't visualize that. We can't visualize a God who gives every human being free will and yet predetermines every word, thought, and action. You only see that doctrine in Christianity. You won't see it in any other religion. Christianity is the only religion that says that we human beings can gain an eternally secure relationship with the one that created the universe.
Does
every other religion...
Does that make it right, though? Does that make it, because that's the only religion, does that make it right?
Okay, you're right. It doesn't make it right, but it makes all the others false.
Why? Why would it make it false? Why?
Okay.
Just because it's unique, why would it make the others false? That's what I'm trying to,
okay.
I'm trying to figure out.
The reason why it makes them false is it's taking God and making him so low and trying to put him in a form that we human beings can visualize that he no longer can be God. So that's the fundamental flaw, say, in Islam, Buddhism, and Hinduism, is that the God that they wind up coming up with, or in the case of Hinduism, the millions of gods they wind up coming up with, are not really capable of being God.
Judaism came up with the first, they were the first people to believe in one God. You're saying the triune God is... I mean, when Jesus was here, was God up there?
Okay. Yeah, both Islam and Judaism are what I would call Christian cults in the sense that they take the Old Testament and the New Testament and they either add or subtract from it.
Judaism doesn't even acknowledge
them. That's what I meant. Okay? Christianity has the Old Testament and the New Testament. What Jews do is they say, we're going to keep the Old Testament,
yeah.
We reject the New Testament.
Exactly.
Now, what Muslims do is they have the Old Testament, the New Testament, and they add another book to it, the Quran.
Well, they're schmucks.
Okay. Well.
Some of us know what that means.
And also, you get Mormonism doing the same thing. You know, they have the Old Testament, the New Testament.
Is that Mormonism or Mormonism?
Mormonism, okay. I do, well, I won't go there. But, you know, that sets them apart from what I would say would be the non-Christian religions, say like Hinduism and Buddhism, where they don't even accept either the Old Testament or the New Testament. So you have all these religions that have in common that they all accept at least the Old Testament. Mormonism does, Muslims, Jews, Christians, they all accept the Old Testament as divine revelation. And then Christians add the New Testament, Jews reject the New Testament, and then Mormons and Muslims add one or, in the case of Mormonism, three extra books.
They also reject the God of the Old Testament, too.
Well, okay. Yeah, that's the issue. And what you see in common with Judaism, Islam, and Mormonism is that they all reject the idea of a triune God. But it also explains why in those three religions you don't see a doctrine of eternal security. A God who's powerful enough and loving enough to grant to human beings the possibility of an eternally secure relationship with Him. Now, there's a reason why. Because if God is not triune, then how can that being, say God is one and only one, then that means that God was not experiencing love before He created the universe. So you've got a loveless being. How do you explain the fact that we human beings actually experience and are able to bestow love? By definition, love only operates if one person is relating to another person. So if God is one and only one person, who is He loving before He creates the universe? And with a triune God, you also have a God that doesn't need to create to be fulfilled. So this is the one. This is what's unique about Christianity. God didn't have to create the universe. He didn't have to create human beings. He didn't have to create angels. He was completely fulfilled in the love relationship that existed between the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Now, in that loving relationship, they chose. They were not compelled. They chose to create. But because they were already experiencing love and able to give love, they were able to instill love in animals and in human beings. Whereas the problem, say, with Islam is they have this one God and they're not able to explain the love that exists in the creatures. This also explains why in Islam God is distant. And you know, Muslims who are worshiping Allah, they believe that Allah transcends. They get that part right, that God transcends matter, energy, space, and time. So just like Christians and Jews, they're excited about the space-time theorems that prove that there's a being beyond space and time. Yeah, but see, they're permanently invisible. The problem with Islam is that they can never reach out to God, and they have no idea whether God accepts them. So in Islam, there's always this, you know, focus. Am I doing enough to warrant God's favor? Am I obeying enough of the rules? Am I consistent in obeying enough rules? And no matter how consistent or how hard you work at following rules, you never know for sure. And it's consistent with their theology because they believe God is one and only one and transcendent, but the Muslim God is not immanent. The Christian God fills the entirety of His creation, but He's also completely free to operate independent of His creation. And by the way, that's where the Hindus and the Buddhists get it right. And they believe that God is everywhere within the universe and operating everywhere within the universe. But they don't believe that God is transcendent. Christianity is unique in that God is both transcendent and immanent. And that God is triune. He's always been one who has enjoyed love, experienced love, and gave love even before He created anything. Okay. Just one. Okay, go ahead. And then I'll get to your other.
Okay. You said that something can come from nothing, but God, Jesus, the Holy Spirit experienced love.
Right.
Then how did they produce evil? Where did the evil come from? Where did Lucifer come from if they were...
Good question. That's a very good question.
See, aren't you glad you asked me?
Right. No, we're glad you're here, believe me. So, that's an excellent question. Because here they are, loving one another, experiencing love, without one bit of evil existing at all. No evil existed. However, they decided to create. And in their creation, they wanted to express their love to the creatures and give the creatures a capacity to express love to one another and back to Him. That meant free will. With free will comes the possibility that they'll choose not to be beneficent in their relationship, but rather be malicious in that relationship. And if God didn't give the angels and human beings that free will capacity, they would have no ability to love. We would simply be robots. We'd be like this computer. I mean, I can program this computer to say, Hugh, I love you. But it probably won't have the same impact as if my wife tells me that she loves me.
Does God and Jesus have free will? They have free
They have free will,
they
definitely.
Have free will.
Yeah.
Well, they do.
They do. Well, of course. They wouldn't
they
be able to love one another.
Love, not to evil, yet the humans have free will for evil and love. So how did that come about? They have free will for love, no evil.
Right.
Humans have free will for love and evil. Where did that evil come from? If they still have that free will. You see that?
Okay. First of all, what God creates is not as great as Him. So we are lesser than God. And, you know, God has a character. Well, you know, we have what's called the doctrine of God's immutability. His character never changes. You know, my wife gets angry at me. Sometimes she loves me. There's a variability in the way she expresses her commitment to me. With God, there's no change. You know, that's what's called the impassibility of God. He has emotions, He has passions, He has love, but it's utterly steadfast.
Well, I don't change. People always hate me.
Okay, you are next. Go ahead. Very good. Okay. What you need to do is go over there and... no, I mean, this is a major core of what we're trying to do at Reasons to Believe. Because that's really the big argument of the atheistic community. If God is all-powerful and all-loving, why do we have tornadoes? Why do we have disease? Why do we have viruses? Why do we have evil and suffering? And you just heard me say over here that God, before He created anything, there was no evil. He's greater than we are. He is an immutable personality. He created us as free will beings. We're not as great as God. And so there is the potential that we're going to use our free will for evil intent. But God already designed the universe to deal with that possibility. So before He created any of us, He created this physical universe with certain laws of physics and certain characteristics of the universe that would guarantee that once some human beings chose to disobey God and go their evil way, the physics would kick in and bring about an ultimate redemption of the created world from all the evil and suffering that exists. And so the tornadoes are temporary. The earthquakes are temporary. And God could easily get rid of them. An easy way to get rid of all the natural disasters is to eliminate the second law of thermodynamics. Once you do that, all the bad stuff's gone. But God's not going to do that until He first conquers evil. And this is something we explain in Why the Universe is the Way It Is, in our small group teaching series of God Made the Universe, that the second law of thermodynamics is crucial to be a tool in God's hand to eliminate evil once and for all. So that eventually we human beings can enter into a relationship with God with our free will intact and no possibility that we'll ever use that free will for evil intent against our fellow man or against God.
Christians
but
still sin.
Pardon me?
They still go to confession.
Yeah, because we're not there yet. Let me give you an analogy. Okay? You know, I'm an astrophysicist. And I got that by taking some challenging courses. And those courses involved a lot of suffering, a lot of pain. And but I willingly paid money to experience that pain and suffering for two reasons. I knew that the pain and suffering would be brief. A few years, it only took me 9.5 years, and I was done. Okay? And after all that pain... Well, that's good, because you know that's kind of what we're trying to do is get people to actually think about, okay, you know, we go through pain and suffering all the time, very willingly. We even pay money for it because we know it's temporary. We also know there's an ultimate reward that we cannot get unless we go through that pain and suffering. Well, I think it is. Okay. Well, I mean, I'm glad you're here because, you know, there's resources here that actually answer the questions you're bringing up. Good questions. And, you know, a lot of people never even think about it. They just say, well, you know, that's the way it is. I'm not going to worry about it. You know, God's looking for people who really do want to worry about it and start challenging and thinking, okay, God, why did you set it up this way? Why is there thermodynamics? Why is there gravity? Why is there electromagnetism? What possible good do we gain from those things? Life would be much easier if we didn't have it. And in the new creation, according to Revelation 21 and 22, all those things will be gone. But they will not be gone until evil is conquered and removed. The physics of this universe is crucial to bring about that end. And as the Bible points out, the universe is temporary. It's not permanent. It's a temporary tool in God's hand to eliminate evil. And once the evil is gone, then the universe will have fulfilled its purpose. God's going to replace it with a brand new creation. A lot of assumptions which can be put to the test. Well, that's what we're all about. It's actually showing how you can put this stuff to the test. Very good. Very good. And by the way, the Apostle Paul agrees with you. 1 Thessalonians 5, test everything. But it's not enough just to test everything. Paul adds this sentence, hold on to the good. Now, a cynic tests everything and rejects everything. But a skeptic tests everything, rejects the bad, and holds on to the good.
Yes.
And that's kind of what the Apostle Paul was saying. It's crucial that we accept that which passes the test, and not just accept it, but act upon it.
Right. I have struggled a long, long way. Clear, sharp, eternal definition of God. A lot of books, even some encyclopedias, theological seminaries,
well, what you will find...
Definition of God.
Okay. No.
Definition of many things. Good, evil.
Mm-hmm.
I do not find universal anywhere in any culture. So far. That's all I can look at.
No. And see, now you're making another good philosophical point, similar to what Al was saying here. If we could see God, if we could touch God, he wouldn't be God. Now, if we could define God, he wouldn't be God. God is greater than us.
Because God is not defined, that's all the Tower of Babel of theology.
Okay, here, no, hear me out. We can define certain aspects of God. There's certain aspects we can't define. Because he's beyond us, we don't have the instruments, we're limited to the space-time realm. So there's a limitation to how much of God we can define. But it's not... You know, the cynic will say we can define nothing.
There's
that's not true.
The unknown,
of course.
And therefore, that's why the Romans are correct. They say, we have this God, and this God. And finally, they say, there's the unknown God. There's a big difference between God of the unknown and the unknown God. Do you agree?
Yeah, and that was Paul's message when he went into Athens. He says, you have all these gods. I'm here to talk to you about the unknown God. And he was referring to a 7th century Greek philosophical system, 7th century BC, where some philosophers came with this idea, these gods that we all talk about, they're not real because they're too tangible. The real God must be a being that's not tangible. And that's what Paul said. I'm coming to you to preach to you that God that's not tangible.
I can tell you one thing. We all feel gravity. We never know where gravity comes from.
Yeah, but we're on the verge of finding gravity waves. So?
All right, I'll wait and see.
Well, I mean, you won't have to wait long. I think we're going to get gravity waves within the next year or two detected. It's coming. But you know what? I'm very skeptical we're ever going to discover a graviton. Gravity waves, that's within our technological capability. Gravitons, no. So you're right. It's impossible for us human beings to know everything about the law of gravity. Now, if we can't know everything about the law of gravity, how can we ever hope to know everything about God, who's beyond the universe itself? However, don't lose all hope. We can use our instruments to discover some things about God. And the some things we can discover about God tell us it's not the God of Hinduism. It's not the God of Buddhism. It's not the God of Islam. It is consistent with the God of Christianity. Now, you raised a good point.
Me?
Yeah, you did. Don't be so surprised.
Now you're getting into fiction. I meant I did. Yes.
Very good. Don't encourage him. I'm sorry. It's not that we can prove that Christianity is uniquely true. In other words, because of our human limitations, there's a lack of precision to what we can determine about God. So it's always God plus or minus. The question is the plus or minus sufficiently small that we can eliminate the alternatives that are on the table? Now, it could be Jesus Christ plus a small enough error bar that we can't detect. I'll grant you that. But the error bars are now small enough that we can eliminate Islam, Hinduism, Buddhism, Mormonism, and on down the line.
Thank you for not
including the Jews. Well, okay. No, as I've mentioned before, the problem not with the Jewish Bible, it's with Jewish theology. Because as a Christian, if you were to ask me, where do you get your strongest scriptural support for the doctrine of the Trinity? It's the Old Testament. It's not the New Testament. It's the Old Testament. You know, as I share with Jews, what I do is I expose them to those passages they probably have never read in the Old Testament, particularly some in the book of Isaiah. This is where you get your strongest doctrinal teaching of the triune God.
Or, I didn't say this, but I do agree with that.
Yeah. So, so again, I think that's important when you're talking to Jews. I'm not against, Jewish scripture. My problem is with Jewish theologians. And I found that most Jews I talk to also have a lot of problem with Jewish theologians. So that's something we can kind of get on the same page with and say, you know, let's get back to the Jewish Bible and see what it's got to say. In fact, I'm going up to Vancouver in a few days, and I got a meeting with a Jewish physicist coming up.
Did I come?
Well, he's asked for it to be a one-on-one meeting. He's written a book on this subject. But what I notice is, as a Jew, he's got this in his book. He says, the Jewish Bible is the Torah and the Psalms. It's like, you know, what about Isaiah, Ezekiel, Jeremiah, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes? It's just the Torah and the Psalms. And so when I meet with him, that's what I'm going to be asking about, you know, okay, you're a serious practicing Jew. You know, what's your problem with the rest of the Tanakh?
Do they acknowledge the prophets like Isaiah and Ezekiel and all these other guys?
Well, they acknowledge them. In fact, you know, they'll often carry the Tanakh with them.
Because they think that God is actually talking to them through the prophets, and a prophet that didn't turn up the, you know, the prophets didn't come through, they would, I think, kill him, wouldn't they? I believe.
Well, that's what Moses said. If a prophet comes to you and makes predictions of future events and they don't come true, then that's not a prophet of God. It's a false prophet and have nothing to do with him. So that's in there. But what I've noticed with serious Jews, they say Moses is the greatest of the Old Testament prophets and David is the greatest of the Old Testament kings. And Moses and David wrote most of the Psalms. So they're okay with the Psalms, they're okay with the Torah. The rest of them, they think, are written by prophets that are not on the same status as Moses and David. And so they really don't feel a compulsion to study them.
Even though it's in the Old Testament.
Now, keep in mind, not all Jews think that way. I've met Jews who've been very serious students of the entire Old Testament. They know and study all 39 books.
Then they also know that the Jews would not follow Jesus.
That was
predicted too, right?
That was Ezekiel predicts that. Yeah.
Oh, sorry?
Ezekiel and Zechariah predict that.
So could you mention that to the Jewish physicists? Just kind of question them in harsh degree.
I'll try to do it in a gentle manner. Right. Okay.
Gentle. Okay, you're right. Gentle.
Right. So, question over here.
To do that every day, but they never saw design.
They never thought where it was built, and yet they put their trust and their life in these cars. And me as an engineer, when I look at something, I can tell a lot about the manufacturer, the people that designed it, their thoughts, their money, their wealth, their intellect, by what was designed. And that's what I do all day long when I work on things. I evaluate this machine, and I can tell a lot about the designer by looking at the design. We have this whole planet, the whole solar system, our whole Milky Way galaxy, and the whole universe to observe in real time, as you said, because it's happened in the past and probably back. And yet people say, I don't know anything about the designer. I don't know anything about God. We have so much information about God, what is characteristic about God, what is divine. And that's exactly, of course, what Romans says. Romans says, these people are without excuse because every day they see what was divine. They know the characteristics of the designer. It's just a matter of whether they're willing to accept the divine, that designer is being all-powerful, all-loving, all-kind, or whether they reject that and worship things that are man-made like their intellect.
Well, that's why I quoted the back verse. Yeah, very good. The verse from Thessalonians.
There's some logic, obviously, problem there because they're putting their trust in a lack of other things other than the design of the universe.
We can read the Consumer Reports.
Well, often what I'll tell skeptics is that, you know, I've never seen a neutrino. I have no hope of ever seeing a neutrino. But I believe neutrinos exist. I not only believe neutrinos exist, I act upon what I know to be true. And so I actually lived my life as a physicist with the understanding that neutrinos are real. And this is what biblical faith is all about. It's not enough to establish what is true. You must act upon what you know to be true. So test everything and then accept that which is good, reject that which is not good. And you know, there's lots of things we can't see that we believe are true. And by the way, I don't understand everything or know everything about my wife. There's a mystery there. And that mystery will continue to exist. You know, I've been married to her for 35 years, and you know, the mysteries are gradually dissipating, but I know there are things I'll never understand about her. And God's the same way. We can roll back some of the mystery, but mystery will always remain. And if it didn't, then I would question whether or not my wife was a human being. And I would question whether or not God was really God, if indeed all the mysteries could be rolled back. And I say that because often when I'm debating atheists, they make the argument, I will not believe in your God until I know everything about that God. Well, then you'll never believe. Because it's impossible, everything about the God. And I often will turn the tables and say, do you know everything about your wife? Try to make the analogy there. Okay, if you don't know anything about your wife, why are you demanding that you got to know everything about God? But the whole point is we know enough about God to realize he is who he says he is, just like I know enough about my wife to realize she's not going to cheat on me. Okay? I know enough about her to understand what her future actions will be, and there's a trust there. Now, do I know her? And by the way, the mystery is part of the fun. You know, what fun would there be in marriage if you knew everything about your spouse? Okay, I love the fact that every day I can get up and discover something brand new about my wife I never knew before, even after 35 years. And by the way, the secret to a good marriage is the longer... I love the fact that this couple is holding hands here.
Even the things I know, I don't understand.
Very good. No, where I will go though is this. You always know that there's a great relationship when even after being married 10, 20, 30 years, is that every day they're able to learn more about their spouse than what they knew in the first year of their marriage. A good marriage is one where it accelerates with respect to time. Likewise, your relationship with God. If you've been a Christian for 20 years, I would hope and pray that you're developing your relationship with God at a much faster pace today than when you first gave your life to Jesus Christ. That's what God wants in your life, that the relationship will accelerate with respect to time. And by the way, I think that's also true of non-Christian seekers. As they're getting closer to humbling themselves and making a commitment before God, there's an acceleration process. I observed that in the 18 months I was searching for God. I could see things were accelerating just before that particular time. By the way, there's only a few minutes left. I'm not going to take any more questions because, hey, I want to at least get to the stuff I came here to talk about this morning. And that was the fact that this particular instrument here was able to make the most definitive test of Jeremiah 33:25 that's ever been done. What does Jeremiah 33:25 tell us? The laws that govern the heavens and the earth do not change. And Jeremiah said that to make the point that just like the laws of physics don't change, God's emotions towards you, God's dealings with you, God's means of managing the universe don't change. You can count on his commitment to you because he, unlike us, is unchanging in his intellectual and emotional commitment to us. And so this particular instrument here was used to make measurements of the changes in these physical laws. The fine structure constant, the proton, whoops, what happened here? Let me bring this back. Here we go. Three physical constants come out through very detailed measurements of the 21 centimeter line of neutral hydrogen. And this goes all the way back to galaxies that we know are located 12.5 billion light years away. Able to measure the fine structure constant in these galaxies that are far away and measure them here in the laboratory or measure them in the Andromeda galaxy or in our Milky Way galaxy. Same thing with the proton gyromagnetic constant and the ratio of the electron mass to the proton mass. With this instrument, they were able to measure those three physical constants over a time span of about 11 billion years. Looking at galaxies 11 billion light years away and looking at our own Milky Way galaxy and a whole bunch of galaxies in between, and what they're able to determine is that these constants do not change by anything more than one part in 10 quadrillion per year. That's about a factor of 10 better than what anyone has ever done before. So, it's incredible that they're able to prove that the laws of physics are that stable over an 11 billion year history of the universe. Less than one, if it's changing, it's changing a level of less than one part in 10 quadrillion. That's 16 places the decimal. Yes. Yes. Right. Wow, this is a powerful refutation of young earth creationism. Every young earth creationist model demands radically altered changes in the laws of physics and the constants of physics. They need it at the creation event of the human beings, and they need it at the flood. These measurements prove that that's not true. Now, typically I've found with young earth creationists, they're not impressed with science, but they are impressed with the Bible. So what I do is show them seven different places in the Bible where God declares the laws of physics are going to remain in place from the cosmic creation event until the end of evil. Is evil still around? The laws of physics are the same value as they were when God created the universe. Now, they believe the Bible, so I said, look at these seven places in the Bible that explicitly declare no change in the laws of physics, and we got measurements in science, the book of nature, that proves the same thing. Both books are saying the same thing, and if a young earth creationist listens to that, it eliminates the possibility of a young earth model. It's gone. Every young earth model needs radically altered laws of physics. Yeah, I'm actually 2 minutes over, so I'm going to bow and close in prayer. I'll stick around if you've got questions afterwards. But Father in Heaven, we want to thank you for physically demonstrating that you are immutable. You do not change. We change. Our emotions fluctuate back and forth. But Father, you're consistent in the way you treat us. You're consistent in the administration of your justice and your mercy and your love. And Lord, we thank you that you actually have proven your immutability now through something as simple to measure as the laws of physics over the history of the universe. So Father, we thank you that you revealed this to us. And Lord, I pray that each one of us here would be able to put aside our pride and humble ourselves before you and receive the truth the love and the life that you so graciously want to bring into each one of our lives. And Father, I pray too that you give us opportunities this very week to share the new evidence that you exist and that you are indeed the God that's revealed in the pages of Scripture. In Jesus' name, amen.